Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome to the McDermott Building. I'm Paul Thompson. I'm the managing partner of the D.C. office of McDermott, Will & Emery, and it's our pleasure to have you with us today at this important event. As you can tell, this is a different kind of building. At the time when a lot of law firms and a lot of institutions are building structures to account for telecommuting and people working from home, we built a building that is a gathering place. It's been a gathering place for members of Congress, for events just like this one. And, in fact, over the last year, we've had over 9,000 guests, since we moved into this building, come through this building to engage in discourse and conversation and events just like this one. CEOs, board members of major corporations, members of Congress, leaders of major nonprofit organizations, members of the administration, and my mom as well. At McDermott, it's important to us that we host events like this because we're a different kind of law firm. We have 19 offices, more than 1,000 lawyers, some of the most highly ranked practices in the world. In D.C. alone, we're celebrating 35 years of practice in D.C., and in those 35 years, our office has grown from 4 to over 210 lawyers and 450 professionals right here in D.C. But what brings us together here in this office and in our law firm is a common purpose, and it's service. Service to our clients and service to our communities. Our lawyers have served in government at the highest level and continue as McDermott lawyers to serve our clients and our communities. We serve on boards of local, national, in international nonprofits, as trustees at prestigious law schools and universities, and as participants in political organizations and committees. So hosting an event like this is at the core of our mission, and we're proud to be a part of this. After the event, we'll host a reception, and please join us for that. You'll get to see more of this beautiful building. And for the next several hours, we hope you enjoy this program and the very, very impressive lineup of speakers. Now, it's my pleasure to hand the program over to someone who actually knows far more about this subject than I do, Miles Galbraith, the editor-in-chief of the American University Law Review. Miles.
Thanks so much, Paul. I am the editor-in-chief of the Law Review. My name is Miles Galbraith, and I just wanted to give you a warm welcome to our symposium today. Thank you all so much for being here. And I wanted to share a little bit of background about the American University Law Review. We were founded in 1952. We are the oldest and largest student-run publication at the Washington College of Law, and we publish 6 issues each year. Now, as WCL's flagship law review, we're ranked in the top 40 law reviews in the nation. We're really proud of that number. Each year, we receive about 2,500 article submissions. And we publish on a wide range of legal scholarship from professors, judges, practicing attorneys. And we've been honored to publish articles and commentary by Supreme Court Chief Justices Warren Berger, William Rehnquist, and Earl Warren, as well as articles by Justices Hugo Black, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Arthur Goldberg. The Law Review is also proud to be the only law review in the nation to publish an issue on issues related to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeal, relating to patent law, international trade, government contracts. We're very proud of that component of what we do. And also, each year, in addition to publishing world-class legal scholarship, one of our major roles is to organize an annual symposium event. And in which we're proud to bring together the brightest legal minds and policy minds to explore in depth some of the most relevant, some of the most critical, and rapidly developing issues of the day. Now, I feel like the experienced and talented group of panelists we brought together will really fulfill our mission of providing like the best symposium possible. This year's symposium is entitled Climate Power Play, Financial, Legislative, and Regulatory Moves Toward a New Energy Economy. I think this will be one of the best that we've ever hosted. So our first panel will discuss clean energy finance and policy and address the state of government and private sector investment in renewable energy projects. Our second panel, which will begin at approximately 2:45, will turn to EPA's proposed Clean Air Act rules and Supreme Court jurisprudence in this area. At 4:15, we'll break for refreshments, after which we'll welcome our two keynote speakers, Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, and after that we'll hear from Carol M. Browner, former director of the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change Policy and former EPA administrator. We're very excited to have them join us this evening. Again, on behalf of the American University Law Review, I want to welcome you all. Thank you so much for being here. A special thank you to Meredith Renegar, Sam Crockett-Neal. Those are our two symposium editors. They put a lot of work into planning this event. Thank you. And the Law Review owes a huge debt of gratitude to McDermott, Will, and Emery for hosting us here today. Thank you so much for that. Now, with that, I'd like to welcome to the podium Jeffrey Watkiss. He's a partner here at McDermott. He focuses on transactional and regulatory matters in energy and related infrastructure industries. Chambers USA has noted his excellence in the energy regulatory field. And he's been identified as a Washington, D.C. super lawyer the past 7 years running. Please welcome to the stage Mr. Watkiss.
I actually go by Dan usually. It's easier. I am the head of the energy practice here in Washington, and I would like to add my voice to welcoming you all here. And it's my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce an old buddy of mine, Professor Hunter, when he was a baby lawyer with my wife early in the 1980s, helped us. And the gris éminence. They started the environmental practice over at Skadden Arps, and I've known Dave and his wife and family ever since then. He's gone from that humble beginning to becoming a professor, as you know, at the Washington College. And he's a real recognized pioneer in international environmental law and advocacy, serving as a trusted advisor to governments and speaking and teaching in far corners of the globe. I read Dave's contributions to the legal literature on a regular basis, not only because he writes cogently, but he tackles interesting topics from different and unique perspectives. In one of Dave's recent articles, he draws on his understanding of environmental policy, litigation, and tort law to explain what he referred to as the storytelling quality of cases, and to argue that climate change is just another, albeit distinctly modern, common law nuisance, threat to cultural property, or human rights violation, all of which he argues persuasively are breaches that the law is meant to address. Dave has a great panel to moderate today that includes Reed Hunt, a well-known Washington presence, who, as chair of the Federal Communications Commission, introduced the highly successful spectrum auctions and oversaw the implementation of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Reed also is the founder of Coalition for Green Capital that provides low-cost, long-term financing of clean and efficient energy. Also gracing and enlightening David's panel is Phyllis Cutino, Director of Clean Energy Program for the Pew Charitable Trust. The program's mission is particularly germane to David's panel on incentives and investments. The program is charged with accelerating investment in and implementation of a clean energy economy. Rounding out David's panel is Roger Ballantyne. Roger is president of Green Strategies, Inc., in which he advises clients on clean energy investments. Roger is also a venture partner at Arborview Capital, a private equity firm that specializes in clean technologies. During the Clinton administration, Rogers served as chairman of the Climate Change Task Force and deputy assistant to the president for environmental initiatives. He is a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute here in Washington. And with that, I will turn it over to David.
And thank all of you for coming. First, Dan, thank you very much for that warm introduction. You can invite me back anytime if I get an introduction like that. It is my great privilege to be here and to moderate this panel. Dan kept referring it to Dave's, as Dave's panel. I wish that I could take that much credit for it, but I really want to thank the students of the American University Law Review and particularly Sam Crockett-Neal, who worked closely on this particular panel. And I have to say, organizing somebody like me is no small task, so I'm very pleased with how that happened. And I want to thank the law firm of McDermott, Will and Emery, for hosting us. It's a great treat for those of us in academia and for our students to be hosted down here and to come down to such a beautiful location. And I was thinking as Paul Thompson was discussing the firm's philosophy for bringing people together and creating an opportunity to engage in the public policies of the day, that this very much fit with our philosophy at the school and our effort to try to create as many events and public events really to engage in public dialogue. And so it's a nice marriage that we can come and do this here today. It's a particularly auspicious time, I think, to be having this discussion and this panel. Much of the world is meeting in Warsaw on the climate negotiations in my field of international environmental law and talking some more. My favorite action at these negotiations now are young students who show up wearing bright neon T-shirts at the climate negotiations and saying, "You've been talking my entire life. Can you please have some action?" But I think it's interesting to be having a discussion at a time when both the international legal regime and the national legal regime are stalled, but yet action on climate change isn't stalled. And I think this is a particularly interesting panel to talk about what's happening in the markets on the ground, where money meets investment, meets the discussion of how we shift from an old energy economy to a new energy economy. And I'm looking forward to this discussion. I'm not going to reintroduce the panelists, except to say that we're blessed to have them with us. And really, I was thinking as I was thinking about this panel, how lucky we are to have such figures that have such a mix of the public and private, and that they've spent time each of them in different ways in both the private sector and in the highest levels of public policy debates. And this really gives us a unique opportunity to think about how these things relate in the area of energy finance. I'm going to stop there and turn the microphone over to Reed Hunt, who I would urge all of you to read all the longer bios, but since Dan did such a good job of introducing them, I will just...
Thank you.
Reed.
Well, thanks everybody for coming to the launch of my ebook publication on the e-internet. Little did I know there would be such interest in this publication. That's what it's called. Julia Cassiati, if you could just stand up right over here, has copies there, and if you go up to her, you can get a hard copy if you're really, really nice. But I'd prefer that you download it from the internet, which will be the next day or two. It'll be e-listed. And if you don't read it, maybe you could nevertheless enter into the comments section at Amazon your wild enthusiasm for the book, because in just a couple of minutes, you're going to see the slides that summarize the whole thing, and I know you'll be enthusiastic since I don't have anything but good news to offer you. Also, I wanted to thank Dan for committing McDermott to a pre-order of 100 copies, and David for assigning it as mandatory reading to everyone at American University. 20 years ago this week, I was confirmed as the chairman of the FCC, thanks to some extremely devious maneuvers on the part of Sam Neill's father, Roy, which I'll be happy to discuss with you all some other time. If you seek government work, I know how you can luck into it. 20 years ago this week, not only was I confirmed, but the internet was commercially invented, because that was the same time as Roy had forecast. That was the same time that the browser it created at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana by Mark Andreessen was publicly disseminated for free. And due to a regulatory intervention, the telephone networks of the United States were borrowed, or as Roy sometimes put it, stolen by the government and given to the internet. The exact same moment exists for clean energy. We have in the United States a robust, it needs work, but we have basically a robust built-out transmission and distribution network. We have, as we did with fixed-line telephony, essentially 98-99% penetration in this network. We have a very reliable, compared to any other country in the world, very reliable and very low-priced electricity service. It resembles exactly the fixed-line telephone business that prevailed 20 years ago. Everyone at that time said that the fixed-line telephone business would last for decades, that it would take a staggering technological change and immense investment that would be completely unnecessary to replace it with anything else. All those predictions were proved wrong within approximately 24 months. Not because I became the FCC chair, not because Al Gore, a friend of Roy and mine, was the vice president, but because technological change had been building up and the landslide was ready to fall. The role of government was important, not actually totally essential, but important. Because what we needed to do was open the door to the possibility of change through regulatory intervention. It was said that you think of climate change as another form of tort law. Well, a regulator thinks of climate change as just another excuse for a regulatory intervention that reshapes the profit-making possibilities in a sector. That chance exists now in energy because of technological change, and it happens that the reform that ought to be invested in and that regulators can bend their mind to creating is the same reform that you'd want to see if you cared desperately about climate change. Namely, energy should be distributed in its source instead of centralized. It should have no fuel cost, meaning it should be solar and wind powered. It should be that the front-end costs are paid for by a combination of tax policy and low-cost finance and are paid back over a long period of time. And every one of these steps actually occurred with respect to the communications networks from 1996 to 2002. In that time period, $1 trillion of capital was invested in the United States, not $1 by the federal government. $1 trillion was invested in the communications networks. Every single device you use today to communicate is a device that hadn't been invented 20 years ago and wouldn't now work on the networks that existed 20 years ago. All the mobile devices, everything you're using, everything you're wondering if you turned off like I meant to ask you to do, all of that is on a power platform, excuse me, a knowledge platform that was built in that time period and has been rebuilt ever since, and that's the same rate of change that we can see in energy, and no one believes it. The International Energy Administration last week announced that in the year 2040, the world would still 80% be dependent on carbon as the source of electricity. If that's true, we're cooked, and it does not in any way need to be true. Now, really, really short, because I really want you to have to download all these slides in order to be lured into paying this price, which is lower than a grande coffee at Starbucks. right? So you could download it and then have the Grande Cafe for really, what, $4 sitting at Starbucks and telling everyone about it. These are the technological breakthroughs. The rate of drop in solar costs over the last 5 years looks exactly like the curve that you would use to define the drop in semiconductor prices over the last 40 years. It's the exact same curve. It's only recently been the case that solar got on it, but it isn't getting off it. Natural gas prices at record low. The reason that we can find all this natural gas everywhere in the world is because of a combination of, I always like to keep saying the same thing, information technology and fundamental economics. So it's the use of radio waves and supercomputers that have permitted the exploration companies to find where to go in order to find that natural gas. If they had to search blindly, the cost would be much, much higher. Transmission and distribution upgrades, battery costs, these are the fundamental technological changes. And what they mean is that now, instead of having our energy policy be, go ahead and pay more, it's good for you, we can actually have our policy be, it's possible to deliver a cheaper energy solution to every single consumer in the United States. For some, it'll be energy efficiency. For some, it'll be solar on the roof. For some, it'll be energy efficiency and solar on the roof. For some cities, it'll be microgrids. There's a range of solutions. But it is possible in every state in the United States to deliver a cheaper energy solution that is much cleaner than what exists today. So 5 years ago, when we were all hoping and praying that there would be a major energy bill in Congress, we had to premise this on the notion that everyone would have to pay more in order to have the right thing happen. Now it's not necessary. Now everyone actually can pay less in order to have the right thing happen. Now, really, really quickly, the consumers now can be the source of change by demanding cleaner and cheaper energy solutions. And you're going to say, wait a minute, this can't be true because I've spent my years studying these topics, understanding that it's important to have costs go up so as to have clean energy pricing, which normally is higher than dirty energy pricing, suddenly be below some new carbon price umbrella. That is the way it was up to just a couple of years ago. But now, and for those who just love the internet, you're welcome to track these references on it right this second. Look up the company called Nextdoor. Look up the company called Civis, C-I-V-I-S, and look up Geostellar. Geostellar, Civis, and Nextdoor. You put all three of these things together, and with the combination of social networks, information about consumption, and aerial mapping, it's possible for every single building in the United States to get the following offer. We will pay your upfront cost, and if you sign this agreement to purchase electricity for the next, and here's the range from building to building, 5 to 8 years, if you promise to purchase electricity from this supplier for the next 5 to 8 years, it'll be 10% or 20% or 30% lower than your current bill. And with Nextdoor, that offer can be made to a whole neighborhood that has decided to make the purchase itself collectively. It is necessary to have somebody pay the upfront cost, and that somebody gets paid back, and that somebody is a green bank in the state of Connecticut or in the state of New York, or I hope in the 13 other states that are coming in February to have a conference called the Green Bank Academy that our crazy little nonprofit plus Brookings is sponsoring. These states are from different regions, the state of Washington, the state of California, the state of Illinois. They have very different energy landscapes, but these fundamental verities are true in every single state. So let's not go on any further because I've got these wonderful colleagues that have to talk to you about some other aspects of the big change. I just want to conclude by saying that it is necessary for our Congress to maintain certain provisions that have been put into effect. It's necessary to maintain the tax treatment of clean energy. It would be good if it was also the case that Congress could take away some of the tax breaks for oil and gas, but I'm saying to you all, economically, it's not necessary. It is necessary to have predictable, favorable tax treatment for clean energy, as opposed to it's on for a little while, and then it's going to be off, and then we're not really sure. I don't think it's asking that much to say, how about the same tax breaks for clean energy as for oil and gas or for all other forms of energy? That's necessary. But what is not the case right now is that the federal government has to engage in the kind of massive intervention that we see in healthcare or that we thought was absolutely necessary in the case of cap and trade. If we had about 25 states with green banks and favorable federal tax policy, then because of the combination of information technology and the technological breakthroughs in clean energy, you would see the upfront costs being paid all across these 30 states, and they would cover about 80% of all emissions in the United States. In conclusion, I will give you the following fact, which hasn't been publicly released, and I'm sure nobody here would ever leak anything to the internet. But I really desperately seek the attention, so feel free to do so if you wish. We've done this study in Connecticut. Under the current federal tax policy and under the current financing offered by the Connecticut Green Bank, in two years, the cost of solar in gray, cloudy, overeducated Connecticut will be at a level when you couple it with these existing policies, 50% of all the houses in Connecticut will have a lower electricity bill if they put solar on the roof. 50%. If we figure out, and I'm on the board of the Connecticut Green Bank, if we figure out how to use social networking, we can have the other 50% get connected to the houses that do have the solar. This is really, really simple stuff. There's a guy on the sunny side of the street and a guy on the shady side of the street. And if we can figure out with the power of the internet to inform both of them and have them make a collective decision, we can have 100% of the homes in Connecticut have solar on the roof that will give them electricity 10% below current grid pricing and lower than expected grid pricing over the next 7 years. That's in Connecticut, which no one would say is the most favorable territory. That's how close we are to the kind of transformational change that worked out pretty well for that internet thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Reed. And I appreciate the positive message and the power of technology, and also the I'd like to come back at the end of the talks to talk specifically about the role of government and, as you mentioned, in tax policy and others. I didn't mention this before, but we're going to have the speakers give their presentations, and then we'll open it up for questions immediately after when all the speakers have done. It's now my pleasure to introduce Phyllis Cutnow, the director of the Pew Charitable Trust's Clean Energy Program. Phyllis?
Well, thank you. If you all don't mind, I'm going to sit here so I can actually see my slides. But again, I'm Phyllis Cutnow. I direct the Clean Energy Program at the Pew Charitable Trust. I don't know if many of you know much about the Pew Charitable Trusts. We are a 65-year-old institution. We're based in Philadelphia. We used to be a private foundation. We are now a public charity. We have been involved in energy and climate advocacy for more than 25 years at the international, at the national, and at the state level. We are now very strongly focused at the federal level. We think that's where our attention is needed. We work in kind of four areas: promoting efficiency in the industrial, the transportation, and the utility sector, working towards the electrification of transportation, trying to ensure we have cleaner fuels in the utility sector, and then finally, enhanced energy R&D, which we are desperately in need of in this country, we believe. So I thought we would talk a little bit today about two recent reports. We do a lot of, in addition to our kind of our field work, we're in about 25 states and our work here in Washington. We do a lot of research, and certainly since 2009, here are just some of the reports that we've put out that look at economic trends in the clean energy economy. We also do research which looks at national security and energy linkages, and particularly what the Department of Defense is doing when it comes to clean energy. But for today, I'm going to talk about two of our reports that you'll see here. So the first one I'm going to talk about is who's winning the clean energy race, and then the second one, innovate, manufacture, and compete. Who's winning the clean energy race is a report that we put out annually that looks at clean energy finance among G20 nations. We started doing this report 4 years ago because we had actually studied state clean energy economies. And we determined that there was a gigantic race going on among governors to attract clean energy investment, clean energy businesses, and create clean energy jobs in their states. And that got us to thinking, well, if that's what kind of what's happening here on the ground, I wonder how the United States is doing when it comes to our G20 colleagues. So, no surprise, 2012 was a year of incredible change. I'm going to talk about several trends, but there are five here. Investment was down in 2012. This is just the second time investment has been down since we started tracking it in 2004. But deployment, the good news is, was up. We had historic numbers of gigawatts installed in 2012. We found that investment was certainly moving from the very mature, kind of regions of the world that have seen clean energy for a good long time, so Europe and the Americas, to the Asia-Oceania region. Asia-Oceania has been on a march to clean energy investment since we began studying it. Never a dip when it comes to that region of the world. Investment is not only moving in terms of geographic regions, but also in terms of technology. We are seeing that, you know, the kind of most mature part of the clean energy economy, wind, has pulled back a little bit. And for the second year in a row, solar has really been the dominant technology that has seen investment. We've seen a lot of innovation in terms of not only technological innovation, but financial innovation. So something that we're looking at is this, you know, residential market, so small distributed capacity, we call them, so essentially solar arrays of less than one megawatt. And then finally, used to be that all investment was going to G20 nations. I mean, a tiny sliver was going to the emerging economies, but that is drastically changing and is going to continue to change. So let me dig down a little bit on the investment numbers. So we did see, as I said, 11% dip, so down to $263 billion. When you look at this, now again, this is private investment. This is not public investment. This is private investment. And you'll see here, you know, if you look at these bar graphs, there are really just 2 years where you've seen a dip, last year and then 2009, which was, of course, the recession. And as I mentioned, more investment is going to non-G20 nations, so 52% increase, that's quite a bit. And you're seeing, obviously, a decline when it comes to the G20. So we could all wring our hands about, oh, gosh, investment is down. Geez, you know, isn't that a terrible thing? Haven't we come to kind of, haven't we peaked? Absolutely not. If you look back since 2004, every 3 years we've added $90 billion in investment. So while this industry, like other industries, is going to have ups and downs, it's going to continue to move forward, we believe, with investment that grows. So capacity. 88 gigawatts installed last year. That's historic numbers. We now have 31 gigawatts of solar. We now have more than 100 gigawatts of solar installed around the world. That is four times the amount we had in 2009. I cannot tell you how fast solar is growing. You know, now we have 648 gigawatts installed around the world. That is more, this is more installed renewable capacity than we have nuclear capacity. Quite a bit. And again, when we hear about all the natural gas going on in the United States and how that might challenge clean energy, more than 70% of all new installed capacity in Europe was clean or renewable, and more than 49% of all new installed capacity in the United States was renewable. So we're really seeing it move. Now, because this is a report entitled Who's Winning the Clean Energy Race, we look each and every year at how nations are doing. And for the last 4 years, the United States and China have been jockeying to see who is going to lead when it comes to gaining private investment. Again, private investment. And sadly, while we were ahead last year with $56.1 billion, we have fallen dramatically in 2012, and China surged the lead at $65.1 billion. So we lost more than $20 billion last year in investment. We strongly believe this has to do with policy. You saw a surge of investment in 2011 around, David talked about kind of the episodic clean energy policies in terms of the production tax credit, which was set to expire. So you had investment rush in to take advantage of that policy and then go elsewhere around the world to try and figure out where they could make money. Investment is not patriotic. It's going to go where it has a regular rate of return and can be guaranteed. So looking at the United States, down 37%, But again, 49% of everything we put in the ground was renewable. We had historic numbers of wind in terms of installed capacity, again, due to the production tax credit, and record numbers of solar, 3.2 gigawatts. Now, 3.2 gigawatts is quite remarkable for the United States, more than we've ever installed before. Germany, over the last 3 years, installed more than 7 gigawatts of solar. So while we would like to give ourselves a big pat on the back, you talk about a climate like Connecticut that isn't exactly the sunniest, Germany, same thing, still 7 gigawatts of solar over the last 3 years. So more could be done here, right? And David also talked about policy matters. Policy absolutely does matter. If you look around the world, every nation that has put strong, ambitious policies in place has seen their investment grow or stay steady. So if you are China, you have a goal of 200 gigawatts of wind by 2020, 50 gigawatts of solar by 2020. Investors know China is open for business. If you are the United States, you've seen the PTC expire 3 times. You're not so sure if it's going to be extended again. Sure, there's a commence construction clause, but you're not so sure about the ITC, the investment tax credit, which is really aimed at solar and efficiencies. You're not really sure what's going on. And so every time you have uncertainty about policy, you see something tumble. Now, look here, South Africa, little South Africa, was barely on the charts last year. They put feed-in tariffs in place. They put an ambitions standard in place. And guess what? Their investment jumped more than 20,000%. Mexico, up 500%. So just having policy in place makes an incredible difference when you're looking at what investment's going to happen. Japan, in the wake of Fukushima, you know, strong feed-in tariffs put in place, their investment jumped. So to us, it's quite clear. You know, whatever policy you have around the world, and it doesn't much matter whether or not it's a feed-in tariff or a carbon tax or what it is, it needs to be consistent, it needs to be long-term, and it needs to be fairly ambitious. So that brings me to our second report that I'm going to talk about. So we said to ourselves, gosh, there's going to be a new administration, a new Congress, and we should really try and figure out what policy is necessary, because we know policy is necessary. What policy is necessary here in the United States? And we shouldn't just assume that we know it all ourselves. What we should do is we should go out and talk to members of our own Clean Energy Business Network, which is a network of more than 3,700 clean energy business leaders across the country, and we should go and talk to others, and we should do it up and down the supply chain when it comes to clean energy. So we did. Over the course of a year, we convened a series of essentially CEOs in these locations around these things. So in New York, we met with financiers of clean energy. In Columbus, Ohio, we talked to manufacturers of clean energy products. In Golden, Colorado, with NREL, we convened entrepreneurs. We talked to solar developers and deployers in Georgia, biomass in Mississippi, and then we brought about 150 leaders together here in Washington, D.C. And we wanted to know from them, what's the state of your sector? How are you feeling about things? What are the challenges and opportunities? And from your point of view, what would you tell the president and policymakers that you need not just to survive, but to thrive in this sector? So they talked to us about challenges, and they said, first and foremost, our largest challenge, our overriding impediment to kind of greater investment, to greater deployment, to greater trade, to greater manufacturing, is policy uncertainty. We can't plan, and it's unbelievably difficult to go out and get people to invest in us when we can't, you know, talk about what's going to happen in the future. And they had other problems as well. They had global oversupply, certainly in the solar sector. This has been a huge challenge, which has really contributed to falling prices, which is leading to greater deployment numbers, obviously. International competition. They said to us, you cannot imagine how, you know, competitive this sector is with other states, other countries really trying to invest in their sector, protect their domestic manufacturing and others. It's extraordinarily competitive to us. Access to credit, that's not anything that's particularly unique to the clean energy sector. And then they said, and also, by the way, it's just really difficult to overcome all the preferences that incumbent technologies have. This is, you know, we've got to do something about market barriers. So that sounded pretty depressing, but Actually, they were very opportunistic. They were very optimistic and opportunistic about their sector. They said to us, if we look around, the great things are happening is there's extraordinary financial innovation, which is leading to greater deployment. We're just really thrilled about that. And not only that, but we believe strongly that the technological innovation in this sector is going to continue to come from us. After all, we invented most of these technologies, and we're going to continue to do that if we have the right policy framework. They said, and, you know, cost reductions, incredibly difficult for us to manage, particularly as manufacturers, just difficult when costs are tumbling. But overall, for the consumers, it's great news. And really what we want is more competition and choice, and cost reductions help that tremendously. And then they looked around and they said, you know, state RPSs are working. We've had a lot of demand due to these state policies, and it's been an extraordinarily good thing for us. And then finally, they said, we really strongly believe that there is unbelievable export potential for our sector when you look around the world. And that's true. A lot of the energy demand is going to be coming from emerging economies, and the development banks are really getting involved. There's now more than $100 billion a year in development bank money coming to the sector. So this is a real opportunity for them, they felt. So what do they need? They came up with this list. You have got to give us some overriding policy goal. We've done this before in this nation, they said to us. We decided that we were going to make electricity cheap and universally accessible. We should have some kind of a clean energy standard, which puts out the rules of the road so everybody knows them. Second, we need to invest in U.S. energy innovation. We invest a tiny amount in energy innovation, and it is, and the industry really can't do a whole lot of it because it's very capital intensive, but far less in energy than we do in pharma or DARPA or defense or anything else. We need to do more here. Most experts say we should triple it, the amount of energy R&D. Then we need to reinforce incentives for private investment. That's the PTC, that's the ITC. So the investment tax credit, the production tax credit. We've got to make these things long-term, or if you can't make them long-term, give us a certain amount of time. And we said, okay, well, how much time, right? Because the politics in Washington aren't great for, you know, just unlimited amounts of private investment or time for private incentives. And they said, give us till 2020. We think by 2020 we will be more than cost competitive, and that will be enough. And by the way, we don't actually want to be dependent upon tax incentives forever. Then they said to us, we want you to level the playing field, get rid of some of these market barriers. And one of the things they cited was something called the Master Limited Partnership. So the Master Limited Partnerships are essentially preferential tax treatment for private investment that has worked wonders for the oil and gas industry, more than $400 billion in investment. And for some reason, clean energy is barred. So even though it has to do with the extraction of natural resources or transportation or mining of natural resources, clean energy, solar and wind, don't count. Just give us what they have. Don't take away what they have. Just give us what they have. Give us master limited partnerships. And then they said, you know, one of the things that was wildly successful with ARRA was the clean energy manufacturing credit. It was unbelievably oversubscribed, and one of the things that we need to do here in this country is we need to make sure that we don't just invent clean energy, but that we manufacture it, and we deploy it, and we export it. So we need to support manufacturing in this country. And then finally, they said, the government's got to really help us expand our ability to export to other markets. So let's not limit ourselves to the United States. Let's see if we can get around the world. So, what's happening in Congress right now? So we have both Chairman Camp, Chairman Baucus engaging in comprehensive tax reform. Looks like Chairman Camp, his effort's going to be stalled a little bit. We have Chairman Baucus, who is going to release four options papers, essentially, none of the four on energy, but before Thanksgiving, and hopes to move forward. In my view, we're probably not going to have comprehensive tax reform, but we're going to get to extenders in a lame duck of 2014. And in the meantime, we're going to have some conversation about energy that is important. And I think this is, frankly, our vehicle for energy policy between now and the end of 2014. So there are a couple of things here that we're watching. The production tax credit for wind expires in 2013. That's got to be extended. They've been given a little bit of help with a commence construction clause, which means you don't have to complete the project but start it to get the tax credit. The investment tax credit for solar, they need a commence construction clause, and we need some technical fixes to the efficiency provisions so that we stop restricting the size of these projects and the capacity of them. So we need to do that. And then, of course, we need to provide access to the MLPs, the Master Limited Partnerships. So those are three things that could be done through tax policy in this Congress. I think that is our kind of best hope. And so finally, I would just say, I think that we're at a real crossroads. We have a lot of strengths, inherent strengths in the clean energy sector here in the United States. We are innovative, we are entrepreneurial, we can manufacture because we have advanced manufacturing and a well-educated workforce. We can seize the opportunities to not only invent, but manufacture and export. But that's only going to happen if we have policies that the clean energy sector can depend upon. And there is a lot of opportunity globally, and we should be seizing it. So I'm going to leave it there. Oops, sorry. You want to stand up?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'll hand it over to Roger Ballantyne, president of Green Strategies, Inc.
Is this how I drive this? Help. Somebody know how I get?
Who can help us get onto his?
I'm just so the wrong guy to do this. Guys, while we're getting that fixed up.
Where's the technology support?
Oh, it's Phyllis.
It's not really. There's someone who doesn't know about.
Here you go. Put it on presentation.
The Luddites, if you're talking about
yes,
technology
exactly.
Policy.
He invented the internet. He should be able to figure it out.
Hey, how about that? Oh, wait a minute.
Just wanted. All right. Great. Well, thank you very much. David. Thank you. And thanks to you all for the opportunity to chat with you. I love speaking with students, speaking with young people, whether I'm teaching or not. I used to be one, and in fact, Roy, you won't remember this, but 25 years or so ago, when you were chief of staff to Senator Gore, you were nice enough to give a little time to a kid new in Washington who wanted to come up and get some advice on what he should do with his career, and here I am. I don't remember what you said, but here I am. So it must have been okay. Well, thank you. Unlike Phyllis, I'm going to stand here so I don't have to look at my PowerPoint. I was shamed into adding a PowerPoint, which I realized sometime last night, and I'm really not good at that and didn't have any help. So my PowerPoint read, you can kind of think like AOL dial-up is kind of the equivalent of my PowerPoint. And also, I'm not going to throw a bunch of facts and figures at you. What I thought, David has some great questions that he's going to throw out, and I'm sure you all have some great questions you're going to throw out for us as well to start really discussing, you know, what kind of policies we need and, you know, what's happening in the energy sector. And we'll do all that, and we'll have time for that. I thought what I would do is try to frame our discussion a little bit, maybe ground our discussion a little bit, which is maybe a little self-aggrandizing, but and not to, I don't want to be a skunk at this, but I've been, you know, in the clean energy and climate fights, I think, on the side of good for a long, long time. And we haven't gotten that far, and there's lots of reasons for that. But I think among them is, you know, I don't remember whether it was von Clausewitz or whether it was John Wooden or Justin Bieber that said, you know, don't make the mistake of underestimating your opponent. And I do think that's tends to be a little bit what we do, particularly when we, and I'm using kind of the royal we here of people who care about this stuff, and, you know, we tend to spend a lot of time talking to each other, which is a huge mistake, because we get each other all ginned up. It's, you know, it's being like at a Democratic Party convention in Alabama. You know, you're like, this is just great. We all agree, and, you know, we're going to take over the world. It doesn't quite work that way. So we do get a little of that. So I think it helps to kind of ground ourselves a little bit. So these are just kind of general points and topics I want to touch again, kind of just framing and throw out some ideas. So when we start talking about things, maybe, you know, maybe we can think about that. But I really want to start with, you know, we got great ideas about this new energy economy. And our title today is about, you know, moving to a new energy economy. I think it's worth spending a minute on talking about why we have an old energy economy. And what lessons we can learn from that, how the old energy economy got to be so successful, which it undoubtedly has been. What is the role of markets? This is a particular bugaboo of mine, and I want to hit on that a little bit because I think it does inform very much when we start talking about what kind of policies we need to get out of it, and that's what I want to kind of end with without telling you what policies necessarily, although it would be probably somewhat obvious. So why do we have an old energy economy? And I think it's, you know, helps to have a very clear-eyed sense and understanding of this. You know, people need energy. They need energy for mobility. They need energy for warmth, for productivity, for entertainment. And our old energy economy has done a phenomenal job at fulfilling those needs. And my remarks are really going to be U.S.-centric, okay? So I understand concepts of energy poverty and all that, but U.S., we're talking about U.S. policies and U.S., I'm talking about U.S. policies and kind of a U.S.-centric approach to these things. The old energy economy did what we wanted it to do very, very well. We very often lump, when we talk about energy, we kind of lump liquid fuels and transportation together with electricity and while they are kind of coming together in many ways, they're really very, very different animals still. But I was, a number of years ago, I've done a lot of work in the biofuels space and alternative fuels space. And I was at a meeting a number of years ago, but I remember this, and it was a whole kind of span of the NGO community talking about biofuels. And they were just beating the hell out of each other. You know, over this LCA versus that and this. And I just said, you know, you guys are trying to dislodge the single most successful industry in the history of the world. And you're spending all your time nitpicking with each other. This is a tough nut to crack. Part of the reason is petroleum is a fabulous source of energy. It's stable. It's easy to transport. It packs lots of energy. It is a tough customer to dislodge, and we need to understand that. Our fossil fuels, looking towards electricity generation, we have made them cheap and affordable. And one of the reasons of that, not the only one, but one of the reasons is through subsidy and otherwise, we have a fully amortized infrastructure just there to serve our old energy system, and it's very cost-effective. And not to be dismissed at all, there are a lot of people who have made and continue to make a lot of money on the old energy economy. Like, all of these are the points that we need to keep in mind as we think about learning those lessons. So if you want to replace the old energy economy with a new energy economy, that tells me, at the very least, the new energy economy needs to do all of those things. You know, it needs to be reliable, it needs to be priced competitively, and people need to make a lot of money building the new energy economy. The problem is that's still not enough, because if it's just as good, it's still going to be kind of hard to displace and change. New energy really needs to be better. And here's where we get into some challenges. Part of it is, again, energy, consumers don't taste, smell, feel energy. Right? What they do is they use energy that does things for them, like cook their food and entertain them and do all these things. So, if I sign up for 100% wind power in my home, the picture on my 47-inch LED television doesn't look any better at all. There's no difference. I can't tell. So if there's other value out there being created, I'm not internalizing that. I'm not feeling that. Now, the good news is there are aspects of the new energy economy that actually are better, and they're better for the consumer and better for the experience of what energy provides. One example, which is not there yet, but you begin to see the signs of it, is electric vehicles. Still on the right side. Yeah. The electric drivetrain, and any automotive engineer will tell you, is a better vehicle. It functions betterly. It's better. It's simpler. It is just a better way to build a car. We just didn't happen to do it that way in the first place, and we've invested a whole lot in the construction and fueling infrastructure to do something else. We still have problems there, range and so forth. We can get around those, but it is, when we get there, we will be giving consumers something better than what they have today. Today, we do see better on I think, the consumer and demand side management side, and we see this in productivity and performance. One example, a client of mine is a company called Nest, which makes a really cool, this is the guy who brought you the iPod, is now, a little strange, but now he's making thermostats. And it is like an iPod thermostat, and the thing, you plug it in your wall, and it's smart, and it will figure out, it basically will manage your energy. You do nothing except you get to watch this cool thing and play with it if you want, and if not, it's going to save you money. You're just as cool, you're just as warm, everything's the same, and you're paying less. That's an improvement. So that is a new energy product which is actually delivering something better for you. So technologies and approaches, and a lot of this is IT, as Reed knows, and all these things are tied together, and it is providing a better experience, and that's a big step towards new energy being better than old energy, but we got to get there. So go back to why, what I think the key reasons are that we still have old energy. And, Phyllis cited some great statistics of, the investments in clean energy and deployments of clean energy, and it's just all great. If you put it side by side with old energy, it is still a spit in the bucket. Old energy has a very firm grip on us, and how do we crack, that nut? Again, let's think about old energy. Why is it cheaper? It is cheaper. And even if you put aside, the benefit of fully amortized, decades and generations of infrastructure, put that aside. In my view, it's really cheaper because we as a society have made a decision to adopt what, in my view, is really a pernicious moral hazard in our policy choices around energy. We have not only allowed the costs of energy choices and energy use to be disaggregated from the market prices of that energy. This, what is largely an intergenerational shifting of cost, has been the overt energy policy of the United States. And now as we consider climate change, in my view, our energy policy represents the single greatest man-made market failure in the history of the world. And to me, this is a moral issue, it's a social issue, it is an economic issue, and it's a small d democratic issue. So I want to talk a little bit about markets, because markets are not the free market, market forces, profit motives, all that they are not the enemy of the new energy economy. And you can say that even though it is what brought us in large measure the old energy economy. There's no such thing, in my view, of a free market functioning autonomously from democratically deployed decisions of policy. All markets are managed to some social end, to some political end. And to date, the interference in the workings of a true market, and in the true market, price equals cost, has been overtly to reach the desired end goal of front-loading price benefits to current generations at the expense of future generations. That's another way of saying our energy policy has been to have lots of energy really, really cheap. That's the energy policy of the United States. People say we don't have an energy policy. That is and always has been our energy policy. And we've used market failure, but then market forces acting within a distorted market to deliver that result, and it's done it very, very well. Amory Lovins likes to say that markets make great tools but bad masters and a worse religion. And I agree with all that, but keep your focus on the first one. They are a fabulous tool. And in my view, one is no less a devotee of free markets if we were to choose a different societal goal than the one we've used heretofore, which is cheap for me now. It's simply a factor of using markets as a tool. So my last slide. So as we think about, what we think our democratic process must yield in terms of policies through which markets will be used as a tool to get us to a desired end, what do we need to do? First and foremost, in my view, it's to better align price and cost. And I still have yet to find a so-called free market libertarian who I can get to agree, although I haven't heard a good explanation yet as to why that's wrong. But we can use this tool of markets as we see fit. And to me, that's the big first thing you got to do. But we need to keep in mind, again, we're doing this in a way that new energy can deliver what old energy does, and that means a growing economy. It needs to be affordable. It needs to be as good and hopefully better outcomes for end users, and a lot of people need to make a lot of money doing it. So my final caution, because I know we're going to start talking about policy a little bit, is, in my view, markets are the tool that we need. Markets and the profit motive, to me, have completely eliminated any doubt as to their worth, because that is what got us into this problem remarkably effectively. They work. It's just kind of you wind them up and you point them in a different direction. They should be able to solve the problem in the other way. So in my view, policy should not dictate outcomes, shouldn't even dictate directly or mandate directly these outcomes about affordable, and it shouldn't do that. In my view, if we better align price and cost through policy and then get out of the way, financial innovation of the type that Reed's talking about, business model innovation, which we're seeing in many places, solar being the best example of, I agree the cost of solar has come down. That's not what's driven by itself, at least in the U.S., the improvement curve, because, yes, the hard costs of solar have come down. The soft costs have not. That's still a problem. Maybe it changes when that. What's really happened is business model innovation. And, now we're seeing solar, being securitized. And MLPs would be great, but frankly, the market's already kind of gotten ahead of that. I don't want to say we don't need MLPs, but we're kind of past that. We got yield codes, and we've got synthetic REITs that are already being developed without any government policy. We can do that. Innovation will come, but again, the market signals need to be right, and there will be continued technological innovation. So get out of the way. Let financial innovation, business model innovation, technological innovation, all driven by a profit motive, and it will deliver. So that's my take, and I look forward to talking about specific policy ideas, and thank you very much again.
Well, thanks to all the panelists, and also for...
Can I interrupt you real quickly? Oh, yeah. I just wanted to note before we get into the Q&A that we're going to try to make these PowerPoint presentations available on our website with the permission of our panelists. So if you'd like to go through in more detail, you should be able to do that within a few days after the symposium. And our website is aulawreview.org.
Thank you. And thanks to the panelists, and also thank you for... making it so easy for me by everybody sticking within the time limits, which gives us ample time for questions. And I do have a few from up here, but I would prefer to open it up to the floor first. If there is, I want to make one comment that struck me. I was glad. First, what struck me as an environmental law professor, and we sometimes categorize law in different ways, that almost all the policy and discussions that were had, and everybody mentioned policy in a different way. We were talking about investment policy, tax policy, finance policy. You know, we could categorize it different ways, but it reminds me that as you are students, some of you, that these are the things that drive, even if what you're really interested is in environmental protection, is that you have to be thinking in terms of these broader policies. And we know when we say that they're interactive, but I found it particularly interesting that as we think about what's going to drive the shift to a new economy or an energy revolution or however we want to refer to it, it's going to be taking it, paying attention, following the money, and caring about the finance, investment, and trade policy much more or as much as environmental. I also think it's interesting that if you got a bunch of people to talk about environmental climate change regulation, it would really be a depressing discussion. It always is when you talk about that. But it's much more hopeful when we talk about what's happening in business transactions, in the renewable industry, and even if it still, Roger brought us back to earth a little bit with how small this still is in comparison to what's happening. But there is an energy and a positive energy out there in the renewable energy sector and in the clean energy sector that we can build on. I want to see if there are any questions from the floor. Yeah.
Hi, Andy Patterson, Roger from EBI. I wanted to key off your discussion on markets and go maybe a step further and then get some of the panel's input. A lot of our dialogue and policy about markets gets lazy and muddled if we don't distinguish between consumer markets and capital markets. And they behave differently and they want different incentives. And so Phyllis did a good job of summarizing a lot of the incentives and whatnot. But in communicating the policy message, don't we have to differentiate between the fact that capital markets are very responsive to these subsidy signals, as Phyllis outlined? Consumer markets, it's very difficult to get consumers to respond to price signals in energy. They complain a lot. They throw governors out of office. But it's hard to get them to make modifications immediately. There's very high inelasticity in energy consumption. And so how we tease out these incentives and how they impact capital markets versus consumer markets, I would submit matters.
I agree with that, Andy. And, you know, the capital markets are less emotional, you know, than consumer markets. And you know Reed speaks to this better than me, but you know the motivation in the capital markets towards you know clean energy has been driven by something. You know, there's either an RPS, which then drives demand for a clean energy project, and a utility willing to give a PPA on that project, and then a capital market with a bunch of tax equity willing to it fits together. But there's a policy piece in there somewhere. Now, in that particular model, the consumer is kind of cut out of it. You know, maybe in these states with RPSs, you know, you got people marching on the state capitol asking for an RPS. That's not really how it happened. So there ultimately needs to be a connection between the end user and what the capital markets are going to do, either because the end user is demanding something, and in you know in the IT world, demanding things that yesterday they didn't even know they wanted or needed. And, you know, capital markets worked very fluidly in kind of helping supply the capital that was needed to deliver that. It's a little more complicated when it comes to energy.
I was just going to say, you know, one experience we've had with consumers, we do a lot of polling and focus group work, as you might imagine. And what is very clear is that if consumers have choices without paying, very much more, they will choose clean energy. One of the challenges consumers have is a lot of times they don't have experience with clean energy technologies. So if you are not someone that's ever driven an electric vehicle or seen an electric vehicle or had a neighbor that's had an electric vehicle or read a Motor Trend article about an electric vehicle, you think they are a smart car. If you are someone that is in a neighborhood where your neighbor has solar panels on their house and their lights are always on just like yours are, you are much more likely to kind of believe in this technology. So some of it is just exposure, frankly. And, you know, we grasp that because we did probably, you know, 8 sets of focus groups all around the country, and what you find is people who have experiences with technologies will consider them. So that makes me hopeful, because with more deployment, you're going to have more people that have exposure. Doesn't quite solve the problem, but it helps, I think.
Well, what do you do with utilities hiding signals by averaging it over the year, because you're
right.
Dealing with seniors on fixed incomes? There's a lot of hiding that goes on by utilities.
Yes. Can I beat on consumers just for a second? Just kind of teeing off that, Phyllis. And even a stranger comment, given what you just said, Andy, which is true. I know it was, my presentation is probably somewhat incoherent, but this kind of price-cost disaggregation I was talking about, obviously it was really more about externalized costs that are not captured by the market and delivered in the price of the product, and that's the biggest thing. There's another kind of price-cost disconnect out there, which kind of sits on the lap of the consumer and then ends up driving these people in that building over there to go crazy, and that is that consumers tend to focus on the price of things, not the cost of things, their own cost of things. And a perfect example, is the price of a gallon of gasoline. Theoretically, a consumer with a 20 mile per gallon car and $2 gasoline is exactly the same as a person with a 40 mile per gallon car and $4 gasoline. But it doesn't matter. They both go nuts over $4 a gallon. Nuts. Even though, give that same person $2 gas, take away their 40 mile per gallon car, give them a 20 mile per gallon car, they're paying the exact same amount. They're thrilled because gas is only $2. Absolutely over the moon. And that focus on just the price and not what it costs, one of the main thing that makes efficiency has many challenges in kind of scaling, but that's really one of them. And I don't know how you fix that, but that's, I just never understood why the people who will drive these folks crazy over the increase in the price of gas don't seem to care at all. And if they do, they oppose, efficiency standards for vehicles. It just makes no sense.
Well, can I ask a question of everybody here? So you probably know how much you spent for a gallon of gas, but okay, raise your hand. How many people know exactly what you paid for your electricity bill last year or last month? Okay, so far.
This is an energy geek conference.
Right.
I mean,
so this is a third of the room. So I think this is one of the challenges between electricity and oil, is that we all go to the gas pump and we all fill up our car. But we all just turn on the lights. We work in buildings where we don't worry about how hot or cold it is. We just call somebody and say, it's too cold in my office, I want it warmer. Or it's too hot in my office, I want it warmer. And at home, a lot of times we turn up and down the thermostat. In fact, you work for Nest. Nest is all about making it so that none of us have to think about whether or not we're turning up or down our thermostat to achieve greater savings. I think electricity is just a totally different experience for the consumer. So I think that's one of the, kind of consumer challenges we have.
But. And shame on all of you if you don't remember First President Bush being asked about the price of a gallon of milk. So she'll go out and know what the price of electricity is.
I know I pay $15 more a month in Virginia to have clean energy, supposedly, piped into my house.
Reed, did you want to add anything to this point?
First of all, you said something I think that really needs to be yellow highlighted, which is the centralized distribution business called the local utility, in concert with regulators for the last 100 years, has averaged out the price to everybody. And it's perfectly clear from all the things you heard from my brilliant colleagues and from all the things you've studied, there is no average cost. There are only utterly individualized, discrete cost profiles, house by house, person by person. So if we're going to have cheaper solutions per person, they're going to vary by person. It's exactly the same thing that happened. Everything to me is exactly the same thing that happened in telco, where you had 20 years ago an average price for everybody. And you could answer Phyllis's good question. It was about $30 for every single person per month for telephone service. And you had some variation in long distance, and that's it. I could ask Phyllis's question about your mobile data plan, and I'd get the same number of hands raised. Who knows, except for that you can't live without it.
But here's what the industry knows. Each person here has a mobile data plan that is versioned and individualized for you. There might be 7 or 8 different large classifications. But you know it's versioned because you get these annoying emails from Verizon that say time for you to have a new data plan. You don't get that email from your electric utility that says, Phyllis, time for us to fix the windows that all need to be double paned. That's the change that is going to occur, that is a function of technological developments, especially in information science, and regulatory courage. We haven't quite seen the regulatory courage yet, but if we have the regulatory courage, that's what we'll see. It's not fun. Let me talk about the whipping boy of Washington today, Obamacare. So Obamacare, the simplest explanation you've ever heard. Most people will pay 30% more, and a large number of people will pay a lot less. But most people will pay 30% more for health insurance. And that's what it means to have 100% of the people in the risk pool. Some people will pay more. Most people will pay more. They may not pay as individuals, but American University will pay more for the health care that it offers its students. And employers will pay more for the health care they offer to employees. And those prices will go up because they have been lower than the total cost of paying for health care for everybody in the U.S. So they will go up. And then for a whole bunch of people that no one knows the exact number of, maybe it's about 20-25%, they will get health care cheaper than ever before, and they will get better health care, and they will be part of the risk pool. And that's the deal. And everybody says, well, why didn't the president make this crystal clear in the beginning of 2009? You could see it might have been a messaging problem. Now, exactly the same thing will happen to grid-based electricity. Most people will have to pay more for grid-based electricity as some people adopt more efficient solutions so that they buy less, and other people put solar on the roof so that they self-supply. And collectively, the average price is going to go down. And everybody who
takes... In a regulated market.
It'll go down in all markets because of these technological change, not in one day or in one month, but over the course of time. Because what happens over the course of time, as you all know, is over the course of time, with coal and with natural gas and with fuel oil, you get to pay for the fuel. And with true renewables, there's no fuel. So collectively, instead of what we've been saying for years, the cost is going to go down and the price is going to go down. But individually, person by person, there will be a different deal. And for those who move quickly to take the upfront cost offers from the green banks that I'm hoping and praying for, it'll be great. But this is a transformation process. To go from the average to the individualing is a transformation process, and it takes regulatory courage, and politically, it's pretty hard to do it with a 1,200-page bill in Congress. The Telecom Act of 96 was 150 pages. They said the less said, the better. Let's let the regulators work it out over the next bunch of years, which is exactly what happened. One more thing. How fast do these changes take place? How quickly can we expect true consumer-driven searching for informed, faster, better, cheaper deals to take place? 2 examples from the information world, because I want you to feel really positive about how soon the world actually can be saved. These devices, PCs, there are 350 million of these sold globally. Next year, there will be as many tablets, not PCs, tablets sold globally as these. That change, the rise of tablets from zero to equal, that's 7 years. That's 7 years on a global level. Everybody knows, starting in the early 1990s, there were small cell phones. These now are called feature phones. There's about 3 billion all around the world. In the United States, however, 2/3 have smartphones that give you internet access and games, and you know all the things that they give you. 2/3. That development took only 9 years. That's how fast true consumer-driven demand for faster, better, cheaper solutions can go in an information economy. And our system today is afraid of that. Our electric grid owners are afraid of it. Our Congress is afraid of it. You find a lot of legislatures are afraid of it. And if consumers just ask for it, and if they see the better deals, it's going to happen, and the fear is going to be overwhelmed by demand.
Let me see if I can get another question. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, I guess directly mostly, you had just used the phrase regulatory courage. And you had mentioned before that the utilities, you know, have been operating in sort of a similar business model for the past 100 years. So looking at what you're trying to do in Connecticut, the 50% of people with solar on their roofs, is regulatory courage, is that fighting the utilities and beating them, or is that sort of getting them to come on board with your ideas, what you have in mind?
It means the following. It means giving up the idea that you're going to sell the political appeal of an average price and instead adopting the politically appealing notion that everybody's going to get a faster, better, cleaner deal if they accept individual deals and make individual choices. That's a different political message. So we go from an average price to everybody gets a different but faster, better, and cleaner deal. That's number one. Number two, you have to be willing in any particular state, whether you're in the legislature, whether you're the regulator, you have to be willing to say to the utility, which usually in many of these states there are only one or two, sometimes only three, you have to be willing to say to them, I'm going to give you new chances to make money, and I'm going to really cripple the old way of making money. You have to be willing to say both those things. I'm going to give you new chances to make money. And that's why you already see some utilities saying, I need to be in this distributed solar business. Because that's the change. I need to be in it. And you're already seeing that. By the way, can this be done? So the two biggest wireless companies in the United States, Verizon and AT&T, 20 years ago were the fixed line telephone companies. And they transformed their business from fixed line to mobile. And the FCC's under five chairs in a row said, this is what you have to do. But you're not able to stay safe and sound in the old business because that we're opening up to change.
There's an additional complication there. You're absolutely right, Reed, but the additional complication is instead of one FCC, we have 50 state PUCs.
It's a problem.
Okay, so the innovation, the policy innovation, the regulatory courage, as Reed said, really more than anywhere needs to happen at the state level. And in my view, you articulated, you know, what I was saying, which is we want people to make money. Give them a chance to make money, but we're just going to manipulate the market. It's already manipulated, by the way, just in another way. We're going to re-manipulate it using competition to try to drive a different set of outcomes. I actually think the integrated regulatory utility model is It is a barrier to the full integration of a truly competitive, profitable, fully deployed clean energy economy where a lot of people can make a lot of money. And those forces are colliding. In my view, the regulated utility is the one that's going to lose in that. So I think part of the regulatory courage we need is to introduce more competition on the electricity side, and that really is a function instead of, you know, having one visionary top regulator in Washington who can kind of do this, we got to kind of go around to varying degrees of talent and interest across the country.
Let me ask a question as moderator. Let me drill down for a minute on the regulatory and policy, not talk about courage, but I give you each a opportunity to say the one thing that Congress could do, so we'll make it federal, one thing that they could do that would help us most in this shift to a new economy, and you might want to opine on the likelihood that would happen. And in the off chance that we don't get help from Congress, what's the one thing the administration has the power to do, and how likely do you think that is? And maybe we'll start with Phyllis in the middle.
I think I talked about the things that we think can happen in this Congress.
You get to pick one. You have
three on there.
I get to pick one. I think the greatest opportunity is probably going to be, in terms of Congress acting, is probably the MLP. It's bicameral. It's bipartisan legislation. It's not particularly expensive. There's been one report that it's expensive, but by and large, folks don't think it's actually too much of a scoring problem. So I think that's one thing that can happen in this Congress. In terms of the administration, I think they're doing a lot of what they can, right? They need to move forward with EPA regulation. They're, you know, the Treasury Department announced they were going to pull back on coal investment through development banks. I mean, I think the administration has put out a climate action plan. That's their plan and how they're going to move it forward. So, I think those are all good things to continue to do. How impactful they are going to be in the short term, I don't know. I mean, EPA regulation is going to be caught up. Good news for everybody in this room in the courts for a long, long time, right? So,
what Congress should do, likelihood of it happening, what could the administration do if Congress does nothing, right?
That's correct.
Number one, tax carbon. Number two, impossible.
No, what's the tax on carbon?
What's the likelihood it's going to happen?
You know, politically or you know, again, go back to what I was saying. I have a very free market approach to this. I want to fix a market failure. It's the best, simplest tool we have. It's not perfect. Whether you use social cost or, whatever the cost that shifts capital to the greater social benefit investments, which lead to a closer alignment of price and cost. That's the number, I'll take $30, whatever it is. Likelihood of that happening in this Congress, zero. Is it impossible in the long run? I don't think it is. It's certainly far more possible than cap and trade. So I don't think that's worth abandoning at all, because if there's one thing members of Congress don't like to do, it's tax. If there's one thing they really like to do is spend money. And right now, they can't spend money without taxing, so I don't rule it out. What can the administration do? I think the 111D rule is the single most impactful thing that they can do and are doing. And if it doesn't get shot down, it's a blunt tool. Again, to me, if you removed all subsidies and you had an adequate enough carbon tax, you wouldn't need to do that. But we do need to do that, and I think that's the single most powerful policy the administration's wielding right now.
The one thing that Congress could do is this. It could say to every single state in the United States, we will loan to your green bank, if you choose to create one, $100 per person in your state. You can have that money for 10 years. At the end of the 10 years, you have to pay it back. We will loan it to you at the same rate that we can borrow, so that the budget cost is zero. That would mean $300 million for the state of Connecticut. It would therefore be 10 times the capital in the Connecticut Green Bank. Roughly speaking, if you look at all the green banks that exist or that have a chance of being created, you would multiply the capital in them by about 10 times, and there would be no budget cost, and there would be no reason why anyone in the Republican or Democratic Party could object, because no state would be mandated or required to create the green bank and take the money. So those that wish to burn coal could do it as long as they wanted, unless they ran into my other answer, which is the one thing that the administration can do is show absolute, complete, and total unwavering commitment to supporting the EPA in regulating the emissions out of existing coal-fired generation facilities, so that basically about 35% of the generation market will be, which is the coal piece, will be eliminated, and it'll be substituted in with solar, wind, and natural gas. That is the change that will save the world. And when I say the administration has to be courageous, I mean the following. The president has to be willing to say, if you want to shut the government down over this, that's okay with me. I'm still not giving up. If you want to say that the debt ceiling is at issue, I'm not compromising over the EPA authority. There is no threat, he needs to say, that you can make that I will not face you down and stick to the policy of maintaining the EPA's authority to take these emissions out of the air. That's the one thing the White House can do.
Two votes for that.
we're running very close to the time we need to make a transition, but I'll give the panelists 1 minute each if they want to do a wrap-up statement.
Am I starting?
Our tradition is to have Phyllis lead.
Yes, exactly. Poor Phyllis.
Well, I mean, here's what I would say. I mean, I think you've heard various kind of tones of optimism from the three of us.
I must have misspoke. I'm kidding.
But
Roger was optimistic for Roger.
Okay. Look, I personally think there is a lot at stake here, and we are seeing progress. There are a lot of things happening that most people kind of aren't tuned into. The Department of Defense, which is the largest single consumer of liquid fuel in the world, is hopping in to advance biofuels in a big, big, big way, and they're not doing it because it's green. They're doing it because they're trying to figure out a way to reduce costs, and they're very vulnerable to price oil shocks. They also have probably more property almost than – they have more property almost than Walmart. Don't you work with Walmart? And they are 99% dependent upon a creaky commercial grid and very worried about it. And so the Department of Defense wants to install 3 gigawatts of clean energy by 2025, and they're marching out. So all of these things are opportunity. And in terms of clean energy and opportunity, that means U.S. jobs, U.S. investment, a cleaner environment, a more secure, more security when it comes to our energy situation. So I am optimistic about what's happening, even if it isn't happening at the policy level. I think small things can happen at the policy level, but I think bigger things are happening within our economy. So I would just leave you by saying, look, I would bet on clean energy. There are lots of people that are. I'm not saying it doesn't have it's not going to have its challenges from the incumbent technologies. Absolutely, they're going to fight for what they have. But I think we're reaching a tipping point here in the United States and around the world.
So I'll just say, again, speaking to the younger people in the room who hopefully are going to carry the torch of this debate forward a little more, the takeaway, I think, from my comments were markets with morals. We're past the day, and maybe it'll change someday, but it's a long time before we're going to be back in a situation where the government can spend a lot of money on stuff, whether it's a tax break or whether it's anything else. That stuff's over. So we need to look at new ways to fix the market failure, to protect our kids, to protect our future generations, to price that risk today, and then get out of the way. Let the people who brought you the iPad and the iPod and the half-inch thick LED, that type of innovation and profit-seeking, let that work towards clean energy once we've kind of put some morality in the direction by which we point market forces. So, and to me, that's consistent with the new reality of tax credits and all that stuff. That's gone. It's over. Let's get on and find a new way to solve this problem.
I'll use my 1 minute to say to the lawyers and to the soon-to-be lawyers that it's really, really, really important to study hard the goods and bads of regulation, to realize that it's in the regulatory structure of industries that you find either, on the bad side, a whole set of regulations that protect the incumbent from rivalry, protect the old against the new, protect certain classes of customers against others, or you see in regulation a inclination towards innovation and change and market openings that give consumers of all kinds, businesses and residential, opportunities to get better deals. It's often thought in Washington that it's really, really important to have massive legislative change or huge fiscal policies or tremendously large movements of monetary policy. And while those things are, as in the case of the financial crisis of 08 and 09, necessary, the enduring year-to-year changes that really matter to private sector investment, which in our blessed country does drive the way that economy changes, the things that really matter
are the rules of the road that tell investors where they can make money and where they can't make money, which is what you're hearing from my colleagues. A short example of a regulatory change. So where did all these filling stations come from? Who's paying for all these gas stations on all these corners that were built over the decades? Well, of course, you can recognize from the signs on a lot of them that when you're buying the gasoline for the car, you're giving the money to the companies that at some point in their history are the ones that built the filling stations. Now, you're thinking about buying an electric car, and you're thinking, where is that electric charging network? And when you pay your electricity bill, you're not giving the money to a company that's building the electric charging stations. There's no connection, electrical or political or regulatory, between the electric utility taking your money and its job of building a electric grid network for transportation. It's just one of a dozen examples that could be cited in energy of the lack of connection, regulatory, political, or electrical, between the electric grid and the kinds of innovative market developments that we'd like to see. That can be changed by regulation. It is annoying that you can't just have an energy czar like our friend Carol Browner issue orders, and you do have to work at the 50 states, but all these changes are possible.
Very good. I'll use my 1 minute, the first half of it, to make an international comment, which is very quickly to say we won't get significant progress in international negotiations until we sort this out back home. We have to have the political and economic frameworks in place for a shift to the clean economy here before we can hope to see leadership from the U.S. and also agreement internationally. So it starts here. So this really is a more important discussion in some ways than the discussion that's going on in Warsaw, even though I'm an international environmental lawyer. The second part of my 1 minute I want to take is to thank the panelists and have you thank the panelists for a very stimulating beginning to this discussion. So thank you very much. And then we will, after we applause, I will hand the panel over to my colleague, Professor Bill Snyder. So thank you.